in the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that one of the important issues in social relations is good-temperedness. We also discussed Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was a highly good-tempered person. He used to behave others very affably. Today we are going to touch upon this characteristic of the Imam according to the narrations of his friends, companions, students, and relatives. Good-temperedness means having kind temperament and being sociable and smiling with people. Just as outward beauty is formed by proportion and coordination of all bodily organs, inward beauty is also attained through coordination among all ethical features. According to the Islamic teachings, good-temperedness is one of the parameters of manliness and chivalry. The Noble Quran lauds Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as a person with great merits. Stay tuned for more on the issue. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "The interpretation of good-temperedness is that the person is satisfied with whatever he gains from the world, and if he does not gain, he will not be angry." Ayah 4 of Surah Qalam reads, "Thus, because of God's mercy, you are lenient towards them. But if you had been harsh-tempered, hard-hearted, they would have surely dispersed from around you." The ayah stresses that the Prophet's kind-heartedness had its roots in the divine mercy. History bears witness that the Prophet would even treat the polytheist leniently in personal affairs, but in the affairs that pertained to the religion and society, it was very severe and uncompromising. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, says, "The most perfect among you in terms of faith is the one who has the best tempers." It is narrated that one day a Christian disrespected the fifth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace be upon him, and his mother. But the Imam behaved so patiently with him that the Christian became Muslim. As it was said before, good-temperedness causes the sins to be forgiven and takes the servant to the degree of the divine messengers in paradise. According to Imam Ali, peace be upon him, good-temperedness will make the affairs of life easy for the individual. Imam Khomeini tolerated myriads of difficulties through good-temperedness and didn't lose his patience. One of the hardest times in his life was his sickness and surgery. His physician, Dr. Motamedi, said that even in the toughest conditions, the Imam would not become ill-tempered. He said, "Imam Khomeini had the morals of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. During the entire period that we were at his house, most of the things that we did for him and the heart surgical operation that he had, he never frowned. Really, in my opinion, he was an exemplary patient. I don't think anyone could be so high in the degree of the divine satisfaction to endure pain and have such disposition so that he wouldn't do anything to upset him." Dear listeners, another worldly consequence of good-temperedness is to enjoy firm and lasting friendship. The Prophet of Islam says, "Good-temperedness stabilizes friendship." Imam Khomeini, as an inheritor of this lofty culture and this progeny, had gained deep and lasting friendship and love among companions, near ones and people. Dr. Pour Moghaddasi, a member of Imam Khomeini's medical team, said, "The Imam had allowed us to go to him at any time of night with just saying, 'Ya Allah.' When we wanted to go to him, we would say, 'Ya Allah,' and he would say, 'Bismillah,' in response. Then we would enter and examine him and then return. During these exceptional times, I never saw him to frown or become sour with us. He would rather receive us quite cheerfully. This indicated his full patience and forbearance." Another consequence of good-temperedness is to self-contentment and controlling one's ego. The Noble Quran, enumerating the merits of the faithful, says that they quell their anger and pardon the mistakes of others. Imam Khomeini was such a person. Although he was the symbol of courage, he would pardon the flaws of others very soon. His daughter Zahra Mustafavi says, "Once, one of the acquaintances had come to us. Since he was opposed to something, he was speaking a little loud. Although the Imam was spending his convalescence, he told him very calmly, 'Why are you upset? Let us speak and somehow come along with each other.' Dear friends, although Islam emphasizes on good-temperedness and leniency with people, it admonishes the faithful to enjoin what is good and forbid what is evil. In other words, it stresses the necessity of being seriously opposed to those who persist in committing and spreading sins. Imam Khomeini was very serious in religious affairs and would advise even his near ones to observe religious do's and don'ts. Well, dear listeners, next time we will start discussing another merit of Imam Khomeini. God bless. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Democracy, directed by Swiss filmmaker David Burnett. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is John Rees, who is a writer, broadcaster, and author. Now, Democracy is a documentary that gives you an amazing insight into the legislative process at EU level, offering a compelling story about a handful of politicians trying to protect society in the digital world from the dangers of big data and mass surveillance. And following 2 long years full of pitfalls and accelerated by the upheaval of the Snowden affair, parliamentarian Jan-Philipp Albrecht and European Commissioner Viviane Reding worked together for a new law on the protection of personal data.
Many people say data is the new oil, the oil of the 21st century. If you think about how oil has transformed our lives, data is going to do the same thing.
Der Knoten meines Lebens. Wenn ich da als Minister sitzen würde, würde ich auch jemanden zuhören, der keine Krawatte trägt. Es geht darum, dass sie eine Datenschutzverordnung verabschieden sollen.
Data protection is a fundamental right, and the companies have the duty to explain what they do with our data.
European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused.
Surveillance is about managing populations, managing people.
That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
It is our responsibility to get these rights in place.
Who do you think would like to stop the direct?
Well, I think we know the usual suspects.
Well, first of all, warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary tackles an important issue of our time and gets behind the scenes of the European privacy debate. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on democracy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, fascinating and important subject, but for me, sadly, deeply unpersuasive treatment. I mean, it's by nature, you know, if you're going to follow lots of bureaucratic meetings with people kind of, you know, arguing over very, minutiae of clauses and things like that, there needs to be something to grip an audience. And, you know, first of all, it's filmed in this kind of very kind of nondescript greyish black and white. But I guess the director would say he's probably trying to avoid sensationalism or dumbing down.
Well, some critics have actually praised the film and its efforts and its monochrome sort of sequences and the black and white feel to it, because it is an incredibly tough subject to film and follow through. Perhaps he kind of, the director made it, at least for new audiences, watchable, given it's a tough subject.
I mean, if people get something out of it, that's great. All I can talk to is my experience of it. And I do think this is an issue that, because it sounds quite boring, people do switch off. And I think unless you're preaching to the converted, if you want more people to be engaged in this issue and you want them to sort of sit up and take notice, you need to get their attention.
Just bring in John here. John, are we as a society largely ignorant about data protection issues? And surely this film can help persuade people of this argument.
Well, it'd leave people going away with the idea, maybe I must find out what it's about. And also, the critical thing you see here is what happens when corporations that are privately assembling data for consumer management, which is one issue, an important issue, flips over into state access to that data. And that's what the Snowden case, of course, revealed. And that's
the only time
when the film really kicks off.
Mm-hmm. We'll discuss that a bit later on. But for now, we're going to turn at another clip from the film, which shows Viviane Reding, the European Commissioner for Justice, Citizenship and Fundamental Rights at the time, explaining the significance of data protection.
Ladies and gentlemen, the citizens are very worried. 72% of European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused. Our reform will assure a high protection to the individuals. A single set of European rules on data protection, fit for the digital age, valid everywhere across the European Union, on the basis that the personal data belongs to the person.
When I became Commissioner for Justice and responsible for the protection of the citizens, I knew at that moment I had to reform the data protection rules. Without trust, no digital economy. So it is in the own interest of the politicians who want to develop our economy and of the industry who wants to take advantage of the personal data of the individuals, that clear rules are established so that citizens know, all right, I can hand out my data. That is exactly what we need. Because in this new digital world, no service can function without the data. The data are needed.
So that was the importance of data protection. Lee, what else does this film tell us about the significance of data protection? What arguments does it make, and why is it so controversial?
Well, I mean, all the arguments that Lillian Reddy makes and Jan-Peter Bulbrecht, they're all absolutely valid, and they're things that we should be concerned about. But I would question one of the things she says there. She says, without trust, no digital economy. Now, the fact is, a lot of people, as they say, don't trust it, but actually, we all are kind of complicit because we so easily give our consent and agree to things and share our details that actually the digital economy seems to be doing quite well. And the issue is, why are we so pliant? And why do we give our consent so easily? And this is the thing. A film like this, or anything that discusses this, whether it's a news program or a documentary, should be trying to alert us and give concrete examples of what is happening with this data and why we should be more concerned.
Surely this is a testament to the documentary, then. It's just simply following sort of the bureaucratic process and that bringing to light and, to this issue to the public eye, whereas we would otherwise not know about these issues.
Well, again, I think its heart is in the right place. It wants to do that. I just don't believe it does. What this does is follow very diligently and, you know, obviously taking a long time, the trail, you know, the process of getting these laws applied.
So, John, for viewers who haven't seen this documentary, could you help contextualise this issue of data protection? Why is it such a huge issue?
Well, what for the first time in history you've got is major corporations being able to track, not by name, and that's important, but in general patterns, consumer behaviour at quite a detailed level. And there's a question mark about whether or not that should be, the degree to which that should be able to be done, and certainly able to be done without consent. And that's an important issue. But, and I have to say, that clip is very revealing, although the filmmaker doesn't make very much of it, because the film is framed as if it's a battle of, you know, kind of libertarians against the power of the corporation. But that's not what the EU does. And in fact, what the EU does is it excludes cowboy capitalism so that the really big guys can agree on the rules and compete on that basis. That's what it does for the European area.
So who else can we rely on then to ensure that these checks and balances
well,
are
in place? Well, we're coming to that, because the people who are actually the heroes of this story and the person who ignites this film is Edward Snowden. And those are the people who should, you know, Jan-Philipp Albrecht, all right, nice guy, green, trying to do his best, thinks the EU is a marvelous institution, wants the corporation to behave reasonably, fair enough. But that isn't really the person that smashes open this whole debate, even in this film. And he's supposed to be the hero of this film.
Interesting point you made. And we'll touch on Snowden again, as I mentioned, a bit later on. And Lee, if I could just quickly ask you, what were some of the obstacles that Jan faced then in trying new lobbying efforts?
Well, I mean, you know, this basic assumption that citizens are consumers and therefore we should be treated as such. It's like, therefore, you know, what's wrong? We're going to give you what you want. This is a shortcut. If we know, you know, the things that you're interested in and where, you know, what your daily existence is about, we can help facilitate that. Now, obviously, that's a very positive spin on that. The downside is, you know, it's about commerce and it's about selling things to people. And unfortunately, the positive benefits seem to get easily swept aside in the rush to kind of make sales.
I think everybody is aware that the lobby on this file is one of the most intensive that we've seen for a long time.
But this has been the most heavily lobbied piece of legislation in recent years. Why is it causing so much stir and interest?
It is important to understand that European companies are a major part of this growing internet economy. Some of the most successful global internet companies to date are European.
It just shows actually the conflicts between the giant internet companies and the rights of the individual in terms of protecting their data online. What were some of the conflicts, if you could shed more light on that, between these companies and data protection?
Well, I mean, aside from the whole commercial angle, there's the surveillance side of things, and the idea that if, as John was talking about, if the companies share this information with the state, what use is that information going to be put to? So in the UK, you know, famously, the sort of Snoopers Charter that came, you know, was announced in November 2016, is maybe hopefully going to be
passed into
last year.
Also known as the Snoopers Charter.
Yeah, exactly. So that whole idea is, if you get, you know, someone in charge, I mean, the US is perhaps a good example, who looks like they're cracking down on kind of, you know, freedom of information and things, then maybe that information is going to be misused. And this is a big worry for people. It's like, if you can pinpoint, you know, maybe without specific names, but, you know, being able to identify people by so many characteristics, where does that, it's basically, where's this going to go? And if you're allowing this stage is, you know, gradual sort of erosion, then, you know, it's open to abuse in the future.
And John, so this film implies that giant internet companies such as Google, Microsoft, Facebook, etc., Yahoo, for example, that they have invested interests in data, against data protection. They don't like to be associated with these sorts of laws and things. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, I think every capitalist corporation just wants as much freedom as possible to gather as much information about its customers as possible and use it how it likes without legal regulation, transparency or oversight. I think that's a kind of given. And not just in this industry, by the way, but right across the board. I mean, big corporations are some of the most secretive bodies in our society. I mean, probably only the state secret service agencies are more secretive than giant oil companies or giant car companies. And, of course, industrial espionage is a thing. So, you know, I think we have to take that as one of the ways in which a competitive, profit-seeking system works. That's what they want. That's what they want it to do.
So how can an individual, take on sort of a giant corporation like that?
You can't an individual. The imbalance in power is too great. That's why they are collective, powerful collective entities. And if you're going to take them on, you need powerful collective entities on your side as well. Mass protest movements, trade union organisation, labour organisations. That's why that kind of.
But why don't we see this then? Do you think there's an ignorance then on the public part?
No, I do think that, and this film kind of underlines this. Yes, there's massive corporate lobbying going on. I think at one point in the film they say 96% of the lobbying that took place over this piece of legislation was from corporations and their various front organisations. And that's an interesting thing, because that will be happening not just on this bill but on every conceivable piece of labour legislation that you can think about. I think people are concerned about that. We heard the figures, but you know, there are some things that are a lot closer to home than whether or not Google has got your consumer preferences, your health service, your wages, your welfare provision. These are things that are cutting into people's lives like right now and matter about fundamental things in their lives. If huge corporations get your data, perhaps they'll missell you things, perhaps they'll try and sell you things you don't want and have things about you don't know about, and that's bad. But corporations don't have the power to arrest you, try you, imprison you, deport you. That's what the state can do. And so when the state has these powers, this is a holy order different threat. And I think we've seen that the reaction to these two things by the public is different as well, because they understand that distinction.
So more sinister issues beneath the surface.
Edward Snowden revealed that secret surveillance activities went far beyond what anyone thought possible.
Companies like Google, Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft got together with the NSA and provided direct access to the back ends of all communicating systems.
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures. That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
The Guardian's editor-in-chief testified before Parliament that only a fraction of the leaked files have been revealed.
It's about 1% of what we were given. Only 1% of the information in those files has now gone public.
Yes.
The EU Justice Commissioner has spoken about the leaks from Edward Snowden and says that new legislation must be put in place to protect the privacy of EU citizens.
Anybody who uses digital equipment is put under some form of surveillance. And that seems to me is something which cannot happen without consent. It cannot happen without the consent of populations. So my message to the lawmakers is, please protect us.
What's the strength of this documentary Democracy, I think, is that it gives you an insight into the privacy battle before and after the Snowden revelations. So you sort of see that journey and struggle. Lee, how was the revelations a game changer, and did it make the EU go into more gear and make more progress?
I mean, funnily enough, the appearance of Snowden in the film mirrors his kind of, you know, explosion and effect in real life. It kind of jump starts, makes it personal, gives you a concrete example, and actually helps you understand and get a grip on something else. The impression the film gives is that that gives a new impetus to their fight. It gives something concrete, and they can point to that example of Snowden and say, you see, this is the sort of thing we're talking about. If this can happen in this case, it can also happen in these other cases, and therefore that's why our, you know, this issue is so prevalent. And I, you know, the film at least gives the impression that that helps win the argument that they, that they're putting forward.
So finally we get to discuss sort of the Snowden revelations now in this part of the show. John, what did you make of the revelations, and was it a game changer for the EU and sort of the battle for privacy?
Yeah, I think Lee's absolutely right about this. I mean, it was a game changer, along with others, Chelsea Manning, WikiLeaks and so forth and so on. But that's the point, really. These are things that come from the heart of the surveillance state, and they're very, very shocking. And they have a political effect about, you know, this doesn't come out in the film, and it should do, but they're about real things happening, about people losing their lives with illegal operations in Afghanistan and so forth and so on, about the treatment of prisoners by the United States and so forth. These are deeply important issues which did have a political effect, and they're about surveillance by the state. And this film doesn't really acknowledge quite what a big shift this is. It says it's a game changer in terms of their legislation, but we've suddenly moved from a film which is only discussing kind of corporate interest in data collection to the question of the state. And it's not surprising to me that that's where the film really becomes interesting. If this film had been 25 minutes long, the last 25 minutes of what impact did Edward Snowden have on privacy legislation going to the EU, that would have been quite an interesting, and is actually quite an interesting documentary. So yeah, it changes gear, but it changes political focus and doesn't really quite acknowledge that it's doing that or why that might be important.
I just wanted to read an example now of Snowden. One of his revelations was that the NSA and the GCHQ here in the UK have far-reaching powers, particularly this country, that undermine privacy and security, variety of means, so unlocking encryption used to protect emails, for example, banking and medical records. And what's also controversial, which the film mentions, is that, you know, why should the US have the power and jurisdiction to spy on people in Europe? So one of the leaks that Snowden revealed was that an average of 3 million data intercepts per day in France, with peaks of almost 7 million in around 2012 and 2013 occurred. So this is the magnitude is just unsort of believable, really. So, and surely that having the EU in place can help buffer sort of and protect us from sort of the US spying from us.
Yeah, interestingly though, we're never told in the documentary to what degree the law that they're passing actually affects the relations between private corporations and the state, and between individual. I'm not even clear at the end of this whether or not that legislation applies to state bodies or not. Now that would have been an interesting thing to know, and to what degree, and do they avoid them, and so on and so forth. I mean, there's also a whole series of issues about the mistakes that the state system makes, because actually it can't process, it can mass data observe, but to get that down to so-and-so did so-and-so and is guilty of such-and-such is a very hard task, and the state often is misled, and injustices and miscarriages of justice arrive because it can't actually process this degree of raw data.
But so it seems like an illusion of power at this stage, more so than the capacity to follow through.
Yeah.
And Lee, if I could ask you sort of your personal thoughts on your data and how it's being used, did this film make you think and more sort of paranoid in any way, or aware of how your data's being used?
Yeah, I mean, you know, truth be told, I'm so aware of it already. You know, you go onto a social media site, you're getting an advert for something you looked at maybe on a different computer 3 weeks ago, just once. That is alarming to me. I got a new phone, I parked my car, I went off somewhere, like a message came up saying, showing me where my car was parked. Now, if someone else got hold of my phone, they would just have immediate access. It's obviously trying to do me a favour. Mm-hmm. Here's where your car is. Hopefully I would remember that, and maybe there'd be so you go out on a night and you forget where your car is, and it's a useful thing. But you're just so aware of this sort of network that's operating and, you know, able to kind of track and log and all this kind of stuff. So I have to say, sadly, this film didn't really do anything about that. And I think what John says is very right. This change from corporate to state thing, the state thing is the real worry. I mean, the corporation stuff, definitely, you know, I have issues with. But they almost piggyback on Snowden to give themselves a sort of, you know, third act lift and it doesn't necessarily tie in together. But it is also doing a service, because there's nothing about the issues that this film tackles that I would disagree with. It's more just the handling of it and, you know, persuading more people to kind of pay attention. I don't think that this film quite does it.
And so, John, just your final thoughts on the film now.
Well, I mean, I'd be interested in a kind of 10-minute sequel, because this piece of legislation passed. We all know that, as Lee's just said, this stuff is still happening to us at an exponentially growing rate. So exactly how effective was, after that long battle, after we've watched all this, how effective really, really was it?
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiad.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Trump has neglected to mention that even with the historic third quarter rise in GDP, the U.S. economy remains in significantly worse shape than it was before the pandemic and has, in recent weeks, been trending in the wrong direction as coronavirus infection numbers soar across the nation, says Jake Johnson Ryder in an article published under the heading, As GDP data shows U.S. economy still in a deep hole, Trump denounced for trying to mislead the public by claiming an economic miracle. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. As U.S. President Donald Trump on Thursday, October 29th, predictably wasted no time celebrating new figures showing a record-breaking GDP surge in the third quarter and working the data into his last-minute campaign pitch, analysts and lawmakers pushed back by placing the numbers into the broader context of an economy coming off the worst quarter in U.S. history and continuing to shed jobs at an unprecedented rate. Just after the Bureau of Economic Analysis released its anticipated report, estimating that the U.S. economy grew a record 7.4% during the three-month period ending in September, a 33.1% annualized growth rate, Trump fired off a tweet hailing the biggest and best GDP jump in the history of the country. Next year will be fantastic. However, sleepy Joe Biden and his proposed record-setting tax increase would kill it all, claimed the president, whose re-election campaign was already running Facebook ads on the GDP figures ahead of their official release. So glad this great GDP number came out before November 3rd. Trump neglected to mention that even with the historic third quarter rise in GDP, the U.S. economy remains in significantly worse shape than it was before the pandemic and has in recent weeks been trending in the wrong direction as coronavirus infection numbers soar across the U.S. This morning's GDP report reveals a $775 billion gap even after 33% annual growth rate, tweeted economist Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. That's close to the worst gap of the last downturn and represents a loss of $6,000 per American household. It's also old news, representing growth earlier in the year. Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, echoed Bernstein's assessment, writing in a blog post on Thursday morning, October 29th, that while the record growth in the third quarter is good to see, this is largely history at this point. The strongest parts of the picture represented pent-up demand and a bounce back from a shutdown economy in the second quarter, Baker pointed out. As we move into the fourth quarter, most of the factors that drove growth in the third quarter are no longer there. We have already seen most of the pent-up spending, and with the ending of the unemployment insurance supplements, tens of millions of unemployed workers will have far less to spend. Democratic members of Congress also weighed in on the new GDP data, denouncing Trump's portrayal of the numbers as a highly misleading and desperate effort to change the narrative on the economy in the final days of the 2020 presidential campaign. We are nowhere near making up for the historic loss in economic output that we suffered a few months ago, and to get there, we would need to see a number of that is at least 20 percentage points higher, Representative Don Beyer said in a statement. President Trump knows this. It is being widely reported. But he's trying to mislead the public by claiming an economic miracle. Americans can believe what he says, or they can believe their own eyes, Bayer added. Millions are unemployed. They know the economy is not booming. Almost one-third of adult Americans expect to lose their home to eviction or foreclosure, and almost one-third say they are having difficulty paying for usual household expenses. More than one-third say they are experiencing anxiety or depression. Those Americans are not fooled when the president says he has worked magic with the economy. The new GDP figures came as the Labor Department reported that an additional 1.1 million Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week, the 32nd consecutive week. Initial jobless claims were higher than the worst week of the Great Recession. Most states provide 26 weeks, about 6 months, of regular unemployment benefits, and this crisis has gone on much longer than that. Heidi Schultz, senior economist at the Economy Policy Institute, wrote in a blog post on Thursday, October 29th. That means many workers are exhausting their regular state UI benefits. In a statement, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer slammed his Republican counterparts for blocking additional coronavirus relief even in the face of dire economic indicators and widespread suffering. Had Republicans joined us in supporting a second robust and bold relief package, the second half of 2020's recovery would be much stronger than it is anticipated to be, Schumer said, adding that the new GDP numbers mask the reality that 23 million Americans remain on unemployment and tens of thousands of small businesses have already gone under. Our nation still has a long way to go before we overcome this public health crisis and our economy fully recovers, added Schumer. Much more needs to be done.
On the news line. In yet another embarrassment for the US government, new evidence has come to light that a plot aimed at overthrowing the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has shown that the very highest echelons of Washington were aware of what was about to happen, as the plans appear to have been conceived in a Trump-owned complex. The apparent coup plot was instigated in the so-called Trump Doral, a golf course in Florida, where the alleged perpetrators of the act met on the green grass of the 12th fairway, planning to overthrow Nicolas Maduro while circumnavigating the bunkers of the golf course in the process. The failed coup saw dozens of people arrested by Venezuelan forces, with many of the detained being US citizens and having links to the US-backed Juan Guaido, hence proving that the US were more than certainly involved in the plot. The clear failure by the mercenaries to overthrow Maduro in the coup shows that in spite of having one of the world's largest military forces, as well as having an almost blank checkbook funded by the CIA, the Americans have a long way to go before they are able to upstage any government in South America, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world, suggesting that the US attempt to fund a coup in Venezuela is a clear failure and an embarrassment for the Americans.
Yeah, absolutely does. It's a catastrophic failure. Just an utterly sort of laughable, pathetic, you know, Bay of Piglets, as it was referred to by many. Not a very terribly serious seeming coup attempt in terms of what the United States has done in the past, but a coup attempt nonetheless. Absolutely, Trump administration's fingerprints are all over this, although officially Vice President Pence has described this lawsuit that we see now from Jordan Goudreau, who was sort of in charge of plotting this coup and signing it with would-be sort of pseudo-president Juan Guaido, who is in fact obviously not the president of any sovereign territory or country.
Yeah, as with multiple lies delivered by the US and their failed foreign policy attempts, the embarrassing failure in Venezuela is yet another notch that the US can add to their miseries when trying to destabilize any nation around the world, especially a nation that's shown the ability and skill to resist, much to the shame of Washington. It seems that the US does not seem to care whether it succeeds or fails when it comes to its foreign policies, with example after example showing that failure is a part and parcel of the US statecraft that we've all seen over the last few decades. So-called intelligence leads in the past have all shown how the lies justified by the Americans and their allies have all come to no results, and have left all the decision-makers at the top very red-faced in the process, with one such example of seeing the Saddam regime in possession of weapons of mass destruction. This is clearly the best example of them all. But in spite of the clear failures demonstrated by the US and its proxies, the fact that they can continue as if nothing had happened in the first place is something that needs to be addressed. Yet it is something that appears to be just another story brushed under the carpet, in spite of evidence clearly showing that the Americans were wrong in the first place. The question that now remains to be asked is whether the US are happy to live and let live when it comes to such massive failures. Or will the red mist settle in front of the eyes of the hawks in Washington, D.C., and mean that the U.S. will seek to gain revenge in the future in ever more harder and brutal ways?
Although I am generally hesitant to draw any real distinction between the foreign policy of the Democrats and Republicans in the sense that they both sort of ultimately want similar things, which is to say, U.S. domination of the world's people and resources. There may be some differences here in terms of the presidential election in the United States. Donald Trump obviously is playing to a very far-right fringe of Venezuelans, wealthy elite Venezuelans who live in Florida. These people are not representative, of course, of any of the normal Venezuelan population, nor are they representative of the normal Florida population.
The truth of the matter is, however, that the attempted coup in Venezuela, for example, is nothing more than an easily deniable event of the past, and is something that, like many other US-backed destabilizing techniques, will remain nothing more than a story gracing the pages of Wikipedia, hence allowing the US to continue their calamitous foreign policies, safe in the knowledge that the denial policy is always best, and that any stories that do eventually emerge will never be acted upon. new study has shown that so far in 2020, Americans have purchased at least 17 million firearms. According to Small Arms Analytics, this is more than any other single year since records began. Gun sales across the country had already seen a surge in the spring because of the coronavirus pandemic, but they spiked even higher in the summer of widespread protests and anger over systematic racism. The demonstrations began following the police killing of an African-American, George Floyd. Small Arms Analytics says by August, the US had exceeded last year's total. By September, the US exceeded the highest total ever. It added that the number of guns sold through the end of September 2020 is not only more than last year, it's more than any full year in the last 20 years we have records for. The revelation clearly highlights the levels of unrest the United States has witnessed this year.
There's been a tremendous amount of unrest here in the United States. There has been the Black Lives Matter movement. There's killings almost every day of black people by police and by white supremacists. So there's a real sense of panic among certain parts of the population.
According to the analytics company, the previous record for estimated firearms sold in a single year was 16.6 million. That was in 2016, when Hillary Clinton ran for president against Donald Trump and endorsed a strong gun control platform. Groups that advocate for an end to gun violence say that the surge in firearm sales will only increase the level of domestic violence. According to researchers at the University of California, gun purchases from March to May, linked to the coronavirus pandemic, were also associated with a nearly 8% rise in firearm violence across the United States. That's an estimated 776 additional shooting injuries. With much more ammunition on the streets, there's more fear across the towns and cities of America. A recent report by the Department of Homeland Security says groups and individuals with white supremacist ideologies pose the deadliest terror threat to the United States. Many of these right-wing extremists are armed and have also expressed support for President Trump. The fear is that deadly chaos could ensue if the country's presidential election on Tuesday is disputed by the incumbent. The eldest son of the late civil rights leader Martin Luther King says he fears that the election will bring about another civil war. Martin Luther King III said this is down to the kind of leadership the president has provided.
Without saying it, you know, the president doesn't say that, but he says what he needs to give people comfort in feeling that it's all right for them to say that this is what's going to happen. They themselves have said we're getting prepared for the Civil War. But everybody is buying ammunition, and it's not one side, by the way. You've got Democrats and Republicans who are gunning up.
Gun owners say months of sustained demand for firearms this year has resulted in a shortage of guns and ammunition. Long queues have been seen at gun stores. The highest sales are adding millions of weapons to a nation that already has more guns than people. With increased political polarization, racial tensions, and anger at coronavirus deaths, as well as lockdown restrictions, those post-election fears are not going to disappear. As one of the world's most talented and prolific strikers playing for Manchester United, Marcus Rashford is no stranger to hardship in spite of his recent success. Having grown up in a single-parent family in one of the poorest parts of Manchester, Rashford himself knows what it's like to go hungry, hence why his passionate plea to feed Britain's children recently earned him an MBE.
People have opinions, whether or not they understand fully what the families are going through. Another conversation, but because of that it's easy for me to sort of dismiss a lot of the people that are making their opinions, because you know I know for sure that a lot of them speaking the way that they're speaking is so insensitive about the issue, and they've definitely not been through it themselves. So for me it's, you know, I'll take that all day long as we start to see improvements going forward for the people that are in need of it.
However, in spite of his ongoing campaign and recent effort to convince the UK government to continue to feed the UK's poorest children during the half-term school holidays, It seems that Marcus Rashford has been left in despair as Tory MPs have voted against his idea. The government rejection has been confirmed and approved by Boris Johnson, who has ratified the vote, stating that he refuses to move on free meals for children during the half-term period, in spite of growing pressure from the public for the PM to meet Rashford face-to-face. Although the UK really doesn't care to admit it, the introduction of a so-called tier system lockdown is essentially a national lockdown in disguise, and it's during this challenging time, with parents out of work and schools closed, that there's currently one-fifth of the UK children going hungry right now. Yet when one looks deeper at the figures in the UK, the situation appears to be really dire, with 15 million people in Britain living in poverty, which equates to around 22% of the population. Of these, 5 million of them are children, showing that the UK, as a supposedly developed nation, has deep secrets that it should not be proud of. Add to this the situation that for many school children in the UK, due to the extreme poverty, abusive parents, lack of social care, and a failing government, for many kids the only meal of the day comes from school. This also comes on top of the introduction of uniform washing facilities in certain schools, as such luxuries for some are only in fairy tales, which for the UK appears to have no happy ending in sight. When Boris Johnson won the election in the UK with a huge majority over then Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, the following honeymoon period saw Johnson gain huge popularity across the UK, in part helped by the wave of former Labour supporters who turned to the Tories over the notion of Brexit. But skip forward to today, and the people of Britain who voted for Johnson, namely the working class Northerners, are now being abandoned by the government, who are failing their children, as well as the people, when it comes to job security and the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. In fact, when one breaks down the failures by Johnson, all of them have an adversely high effect on the poorest populations of the country. As mentioned, there are children going hungry. The handling of the Brexit negotiations, which are likely to see the UK come crashing out of the EU with no deal, and the terrible handling of the pandemic, which has seen the NHS collapse, testing fail, a death rate in excess of 45,000 people, and around 100,000 people per day newly infected. Yet in spite of all this, Boris Johnson's able to find himself in front of the cameras, claiming that he will not let the British people suffer, or the children go hungry.
Well, let's be absolutely clear. We're going to make sure that we have no children, no kids, no pupils in our country who go hungry this winter, certainly not as a result of any government inattention. We're focusing on that, as we have done very, very hard over the last few months, and we've given, you know, huge sums to local councils to help them out, but also specific sums for helping with meals during what was a very disrupted period.
Yet with Britain clearly becoming the laughing stock of Europe, it seems that the only way to judge the Conservative government of Boris Johnson is through humour, which, as seen in this picture, shows Johnson's front bench openly mocking the situation British children find themselves in. The point, however, that Johnson should be most worried about is, why did it take a Manchester United football player to raise the issue that children are going hungry? Surely this should have been the job of the UK government. And as Marcus Rashford continues to fire on all cylinders, it seems that Boris Johnson is missing the target.
The French president has faced a huge backlash in his views against Islam. Emmanuel Macron's comments on the denunciation of Islam and in defense of secularism have drawn widespread backlash from Muslim activists and advocates of the noble religion. Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has denounced France's stance on insults to Muslims and their sanctities, saying such moves are opportunistic abuse of freedom of speech that would only fuel extremism. Zarif also added that Muslims are the primary victims of the cult of hatred that has been empowered by colonial regimes. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, also advised the French president to read more history and not to rejoice in the support of a declining America and Zionism.
I mean,
it's quite clear, like we all, like everybody knows the history of what France did in Algeria, okay? They occupied that place for 200 years, humiliating, mass murdering, mass murders, you know, breaching Islamic laws, and, you know, disrespecting the Muslims as a whole. And they've also, you know, done a lot of colonial projects inside France in different areas.
Iran has also summoned the French chargé d'affaires to protest the anti-Muslim comments by the country's president. Meanwhile, Muslims have attended protests in Bangladesh, Iraq, Palestine, Pakistan, and many other countries calling for a boycott of French goods. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has criticized Macron, saying the French leader needed mental checks over his attitude towards Islam. A boycott of French products is already underway in supermarkets in the Persian Gulf kingdoms of Qatar and Kuwait. It's also been demanded in Jordan and Turkey. Macron has unveiled a plan to defend France's secular values against what he labeled as Islamist radicalism. He's also claimed that the religion was in crisis all over the world. Macron has underlined that no concessions would be made in a new drive to eliminate religion from education and the public sector in the country. The French president also said his government would present a bill in December that would strengthen the country's law that officially separated religion and state. Macron's plans also include restricting funds that Muslim communities receive from abroad, supposedly limiting foreign influence.
As he sees these cartoons and these, you know, despicable pictures defaming and disrespecting a highly important figure for Muslims, one of the most highest figures, the Prophet Muhammad, and, you know, with no regards to these people's feelings. So, you know, we're talking about French Muslim citizens, and we're talking about the Muslims in the world. We're talking about 1.9 billion Muslims that are affected by this, you know.
Macron's comments came less than a month after Muslim protesters censured Charlie Hebdo, a French weekly satirical magazine, for its recent reprinting of blasphemous caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. A second event, the killing of teacher Samuel Paty, who had shown the blasphemous cartoons in his class, has led to further upset. While Muslims condemned the gruesome killing, the response from French officials had been perceived as linking Islam with terrorism. There are also fears of collective punishment.
I mean, it's not in the interest of France, because they have a majority of Muslims compared to the whole West. I mean, they have the biggest population of Muslims in the Western world.
It's believed Macron needs to fight systemic racism in his country and provide opportunities for Muslims who have been radicalized at the margins of French society. It's also been suggested that Macron's secularist push is partly efforts to gain votes in the upcoming elections. The rise of far-right ideology and the propagation of anti-immigration policies have exacerbated the status of religious minorities in France.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.